Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Schleter, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning. You sit. We are at the Court of Appeals this morning. It is Thursday, February 22nd, and we have three cases scheduled for oral argument today. As our marshal noted, I'm Judge Sarah Wheelock. I'm sitting with Judge Schleter and Judge Schmidt, and we are holding these arguments in Courtroom 100 of the Minnesota Judicial Center. Our oral arguments are recorded. There will be an audio recording available on our website within about 24 hours of today. And with that, I think we're ready for the marshal to call the first case.
The first case this morning is A231478, in re the receivership of United Prairie Bank versus Molnow Trucking LLC et al. Granite Re Inc.
Okay. And counsel, as you probably already know, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial argument, with appellant getting an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium in the center does move up and down if you'd like to adjust it. There's a button on the front, and there should be a timer there as well. Our trustee marshal will be running that timer. So at the beginning, just remember to introduce yourself and also the name of the client that you're representing, so we have that for our recording. And with that, counsel for appellant, please feel free to begin when you are ready.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Dan Gregerson. I'm with the law firm of Gregerson, Rosso, Johnson, and Nyland. I represent the appellant, Granite Re Inc., their surety company, domiciled in Minnesota, with its principal place of business now located in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I know that these oral arguments tend to be conversations, and so unless the court wants me to go into the facts, I won't do that. I think the facts here are relatively discreet and they do not appear to be in dispute. We are here on kind of a classic interesting case of suretyship. And suretyship is a concept that has gone back thousands of years. It was codified to some extent for purposes of construction by the federal act known as the Miller Act, and in Minnesota law, and in indeed lots of state jurisdictions known as the Little Miller Act. And the purposes of suretyship is a three-party agreement. You have the surety, which makes the promise to the beneficiary or the obligee of the bond, oftentimes the owner or subcontractors and suppliers, that the job will be performed or that the subs and suppliers will be paid. You have the principal, who in this instance is the contractor, Molnow Trucking, and that party ultimately has the responsibility for those promises, but if they fail to do so, that's what the surety is there to do. And so when the bond principal fails to do that, unless there are any defenses to the surety is compelled to act. And that is exactly what we have here. In my experience in representing surety companies over the past 20 years, the arguments are almost always between banks and sureties as who gets bonded contract funds. For the purposes of suretyship, it is, quite frankly, the surety's most important collateral and security, because in the event that the bond principal fails to act and the surety is compelled to do so under its bonds, either to the owner to perform or to subcontractors and suppliers to pay, they know that they can get those contract funds to offset their losses. And through the course of American jurisprudence, what has been developed to help the surety do that and secure that is the doctrine of equitable subrogation.
Mr. Gregerson, can I ask you, before you get into that, I've noticed throughout your briefing, and you mentioned here about obligated, have no choice. By that, you mean once you decide to issue the bond, right? Or sign, perhaps, and I don't know if it's the indemnity agreement itself that obligates. I assume there's terms in there, but isn't it true that your client could decline if, for instance, you had a concern about the security being provided for that? So that's what kind of gets to the heart, of course, what we're talking about here and is the issue. So you're not obligated. In that sense, isn't it the same as a bank who decides whether to lend money at all to a given client, customer? They want to see what kind of security you have to secure that money.
Yeah,
so in that sense, you're in the same footing as the bank.
A little bit, but I think the cases, and I'll defer to our brief, which unfortunately Justine Wagner left our firm before she could argue the case. But I think it's well briefed, and I think that the courts have looked at that issue specifically about whether a general lender, creditor, bank is a volunteer vis-a-vis whether a surety is really a volunteer. And I think what I would point out to the court is these jobs don't get done because the statutes require the bond. So whether it's Granite or somebody else, somebody has to bond that job for that work to get done. And so in that instance, the surety is not a volunteer, any surety. Someone's going to have to do that job or it doesn't get done. Once it does take it over, once the surety does issue the bonds, then it is further true, that the surety is going to be compelled if the contractor fails to do what it is supposed to do.
But the point being, though, is you can choose not to be a surety for a particular project or a particular contractor.
That is true, yes. But the challenge then becomes 574 and the Little Miller Act and the statutes we have in place become almost impossible to perform because any contract over $175,000 in the state of Minnesota has to be bonded. There is no choice. And so for the contractor to do work, for anyone to get paid, they have to have a bond. And so to that extent, the surety, I think, is afforded some unique protection. It is called by old cases from the U.S. Supreme Court a specialized and most cherished creditor. And that's what it is, because it does perform a duty that others don't. For example, there are some cases that we've cited in our brief. I think it's the Minnesota case concerning when the court was balancing the equities with the bank and vis-a-vis the surety as to contract funds. There's a unique position there. In that instance, in that case, the bank was obligated and actually paid for the subcontractors and suppliers that remain unpaid. In other words, they were obligated by their own lending documents to do that, and under equitable subrogation, the equities fell to them because they essentially took over the surety's obligations to pay its subcontractors and suppliers. And so what I'm here for really, most importantly, is I think the district court missed an opportunity to weigh the equities under the doctrine of equitable subrogation. And I think it's important that, noting the district court's decision, which was essentially a default to a first-in-time analysis, a priority analysis, which really sounds and rings in the UCC. They said, well, since the bank had filed its UCC and perfected that interest before your bonds were issued, that's it. And I think if the court adopts that position, then equitable subrogation is effectively neutered.
But counsel, isn't it correct that it wasn't only that it existed, it's that they had filed it with the Secretary of State, and so everybody was on notice that existed. And so when choosing to then fulfill its obligation under the bond agreement, it essentially knew that the bank had some kind of priority lien.
Yep, and that's true, Your Honor, that is true. However, even applying that analysis, every surety then takes the risk, I suspect, or hopes or promises that the bank is going to play ball. But I think even if you say, well, you should have done that, or the surety was negligent in not doing so, it's still then automatically what we're doing is defaulting to a first-in-time analysis, and I don't think that's really the law. The doctrine of equitable subrogation doesn't have those bright-line rules. The Pharisee case talks about that. The whole purpose of equitable subrogation is to prevent and to encourage natural justice and prevent unjust enrichment. And so if we say, well, you could have known, and so therefore you didn't have to issue the bond, then there's no need to ever argue equitable subrogation.
But it's not that you could have known, it's that you did know, right? I mean, in this situation, I guess I'm wondering how you expect the courts to apply the equitable principles when one of the facts that they're looking at is that, in fact, your client knew?
Well, yeah, I don't know if it's in the record that the surety knew or didn't know exactly when the UCC was filed. But regardless, my point is, and I think the court is getting there, I think you're alluding to it, is that that's one of maybe many factors in an equitable subrogation analysis. My point is that the district court didn't even get to that. They just said, well, because they were filed first, that's it. That isn't an analysis. That's just a default to the priority. And so if the court had gone through and said, okay, let's talk about the equity factors. Let's talk about the fact that the bank has been paid already under its collateral, accounts receivable, what they had. Let's talk about the fact that the bank didn't pay these people, but the surety is obligated to do so. I think our brief is replete with case law that talks about the importance of equitable subrogation, and so my concern is that if we kind of go down this road, there is no analysis that's been done by the district court at all.
But I don't read the order quite that way. In fact, it looks like that was the initial one of two arguments made by the bank and the court. I'm looking in the middle of, in its memorandum, middle of page 6, where the first argument was simply accounts receivable is superior because the financing statement was first in time. That's the UCC argument. UPB's initial argument is therefore summarily rejected. In other words, the court seemed to understand and then actually went to the same case that all of you are citing, the Barrett case, which also referenced the fact that in that case the surety had had security that preceded that of a transferee. I can't remember all the details of the contractor. So what I'm getting at is it seemed like the court was indeed looking at the correct law, seemed to acknowledge equitable subrogation is not synonymous. In fact, it's separate from the UCC. But on the other hand, as Judge Wheelock points out, it seems like what else would you look at in terms of the equities of a situation but that one knew there was a superior lien holder such that you'd either contract with your principal to assure that there's some subordination agreement or something before the bond is issued.
Yeah, we are all looking at the same two cases, and despite the fact that I have a fairly thick book and it's maybe just split up in theirs, to me those are the two cases that are really at issue for purposes of Minnesota. In my humble opinion, the rest of the nation seems to support the surety's position of performing that equitable subrogation analysis.
You know, would we have to then overrule Barrett and RW Farms?
No, I don't think that there's a necessarily overruling because Barrett, as we all know, actually found for the surety using equitable subrogation. And it went through and talked about the other equity analysis, the other factors that were there. And it weighed the surety's bond obligations mandated by statute. Without the bond, the contract funds wouldn't exist. It weighed the lender's argument about advancing funds. None of that was done here. RW Farms is interesting because, A, I argued it, and maybe you read that and you're wondering why I'm here today. But I think what RW Farms was, the focus there was essentially on the first-in-time analysis. And it puts me in a difficult position to come back to the Court of Appeals and say, you know, I don't think RW Farms should have been argued that way at the time that I argued it. I'd like you to reconsider it. The surety won in that case, but it's an unreported decision. It's unpublished, and I don't think we have the same facts that we have here as far as what Judge Sleater has pointed out. Here we have prior, the bank, and Judge Wheelock has pointed out, prior the bank has the UCC filing, and then the bonds are executed later. There are other cases that directly talk about that and say, UCC is fine. You should go through and balance the equities. And so it's okay to have a first-in-time argument if that's where we want to go. But I think at the end of the day, RW Farms, we could have gone further and said, no, no, what we should be doing is what the rest of the country is doing, which is balancing the equities. Because, again, my concern is that if we just say, well, the only equity we're going to look at is the fact that the UCC was filed, whether the sureties or any surety should file its own UCC or whether they should be looking at that before issuing the bond, that's only one equity. Why don't we look at the entire picture? That's the purpose of the doctrine of equitable subrogation. We're not here, as Farisee says, to create bright line rules when we're talking about equitable subrogation. So respectively, I don't think the district court did much of that. They just defaulted to, in its decision, and acknowledged that, you know, it's a first in time. And I think the way they left it off was something to the effect of, and I want to quote the judge correctly, placing improper emphasis on the timeline of the surety relationship to the filing of the UCC. We're not making that determination now, and you can do that at appeal at the Court of Appeals if appropriate. And so here we are. To me, that is the thrust of this case. It's the most important thing. Are we going to apply the doctrine of equitable subrogation? And if we're not, then in Minnesota, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether, you know, the surety automatically loses every time. So I don't see a balancing of equities there. I see a bright line rule, which Farisee says, don't do that for equitable subrogation. So we can remand this case back to the district court and tell the judge respectfully, hey, look, have some briefing on the equities, and then the judge makes the decision, and the judge will balance the equities in favor of one or the other. But you've got to at least do it.
Even under your analysis, you're not disputing that the fact that the bank filed with the Secretary of State is a factor that needs to be considered.
I think it can be one of the factors.
Yeah, how much weight does that factor get?
Because, well,
it seems pretty important, because your client had the opportunity to negotiate higher rates or other terms of that agreement, knowing that the bank has already filed and that this is there.
Sure. No, I think that is a factor, but I would also encourage Your Honor to look at the cases that have talked about the bank's arguments about, well, this is UCC Article 9, and we have followed that, and we have filed that. And respectfully, I think as recently as, and I see my time's up, I just want to answer your question, a bankruptcy decision within the past 4 or 5 years out of Nebraska talked about, wait a minute, when we're talking about equitable subrogation, Article 9 is not an automatic winner. I mean, they talk about giving the blue ribbon to the surety. I'm not even asking for that. I'm asking no bright line rule applied, send me back and let's balance the equities. It may be an equity that they filed a UCC-9 and whether the surety could or couldn't have looked at it. But then if that's the case, I should also be able to argue my equities as well. What they've been paid, surety's been paid zero. The fact that the surety did what it was compelled to do when it issued the bonds, it paid those subcontractors and suppliers. Bank didn't do that. We did. Why are they profiting off of what we have done?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal. So now we turn to counsel for respondent. And again, feel free to adjust the podium. The clock is reset, and you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kyle Kroll from Winthrop and Weinstein on behalf of the respondent, United Prairie Bank. And may it please the court. United Prairie Bank respectfully requests affirmance in all respects. There are two key undisputed facts that set this case apart from all of the cases that were cited by Granite Ray to this court and require affirmance under Minnesota precedent. The first is that United Prairie Bank perfected its security interest in Molnau Trucking's accounts receivable and other assets several months before Granite Ray thereafter chose to issue bonds to Molnau Trucking for public works projects. And the second key undisputed fact is that United Prairie Bank publicly filed UCC financing statements on those assets in April, May, and September 2020, giving Granite Ray and the world notice of its perfected security interests that would take priority. Now, effectively, Granite Ray seeks to ignore these dispositive facts and invent for sureties something akin to super priority status over all others, including prior perfected secured creditors under the theory of equitable subrogation. But Minnesota law, such as in the UCC, does not afford any super priority to Granite Ray under these facts because UPB perfected its security interest before Granite Ray issued any bonds. Under equitable subrogation, Granite Ray can only be subrogated to Molnau Trucking's rights at the time that Granite Ray became surety. It effectively stands in the shoes of Molnau Trucking at that time. But those rights were already encumbered by UPB's perfected security interests under the UCC. And so Granite Ray standing in the shoes of Molnau Trucking via subrogation cannot take more than what Molnau Trucking possessed at that time. Nor do the equities afford super priority to Granite Ray, because Granite Ray had notice, as Your Honor's questions pointed out, of UPB's prior perfected security interests. And Granite Ray at the district court did not meet its burden to show that the equities clearly and substantially favor Granite Ray over United Prairie Bank. Equity aids the vigilant, not the negligent. And that means sureties must conduct due diligence, must take steps to protect their interests if they learn that, for example, there's a prior perfected secured creditor.
Can I ask, Mr. Kroll, you acknowledge, that, because it sounds like, and your argument is kind of precisely the concern an appellant raises, is that it just simply becomes an Article 9 first in time method. And so I assume you would concede that your client also doesn't have super seniority in a non-Article 9 scenario. In other words, that's not the only issue that you look at. And the point being, of course, they've acknowledged the factor, and arguably it's a major factor that they were on notice, but that just kind of begins the discussion, doesn't it, in terms of equities, including when you look at zero versus money and actually it was a benefit to your client, of course, that they paid this, you know, the subcontractor. So there. What evidence do we have besides the order itself in the record that the judge actually considered those things in addition to simply the first in time?
Yes, Your Honor. There are undisputed facts that before the court that ordinarily, perhaps, if there were disputed facts, a district court would weigh those first and then make determinations. But here there are undisputed facts about the notice, about the timing of everything, and the roles that the parties play. And so those are all set out in the district court's order. Now, while the district court did not explicitly expressly address the weighing of these equities, this court can affirm on any ground, and we think because of the undisputed facts, if the court were to feel the need to make it to questions about whether, in terms of equity, Granite Ray met its burden first, or whether the equities in fact substantially and clearly favor Granite Ray, that the court could make that determination just as well as the district court would, and there would be no need for remand. But I'd like to get back to the first part of your question, which was it a first-in-time analysis? And it wasn't. It was much more than that. As I said in the introduction, the district court rejected a basic first-in-time analysis and then proceeded to address the Minnesota Supreme Court's precedents in Barrett Brothers, and then this court's prior decision in R.W. Farms, to analyze what rights were the surety subrogated to. And those were rights that were already encumbered. And that's where you don't even need to get to an equitable weighing or balancing or any of the equitable issues, because applying those precedents to this situation, Granite Ray cannot have priority or take more than what Molnau Trucking had at that time. Again, it's subrogated to an already encumbered interest under the Uniform Commercial Code because of those perfected security interests. And so the court doesn't even need to get to that. It's a simple matter of affirming the exact same reasoning that the district court engaged in. Derivative of Barrett Brothers and R.W. Farms.
Would it have been appropriate for the district court to say, a major factor against the surety is the timing and the notice, but on the other hand, because they were paid nothing, and so I'm going to split the baby and order $250,000 or whatever number. Would you agree that would have been appropriate under the current law for a court to have done that?
No, I would not agree with that, if I understand your question correctly, Judge Sleater. In order for equitable subrogation to even apply, in order for Granite Ray to then have an equitable to have an equitable subrogation right, so to speak, it would have to show again, that it's entitled to that right by because it made a justifiable or excusable mistake of fact, and that an innocent party wouldn't be harmed. The court, district court did set those standards out in its order. It didn't ultimately get to that point because it effectively assumed that, that Granite Ray could have such an interest. But because of the UCC notice or the filing notices here, that first prong would not be met. So the surety would not have acted in a justifiable or under an excusable mistake of fact because it was on notice of this prior perfected security interest. So it would never even get to a point where we're weighing who should ultimately have priority in a setting in which there's an equitable right of subrogation and a perfected security interest that are considered equal, which is kind of what the In re Bukowski case, bankruptcy case from Judge Dreher talked a little bit about. But and then on the other second prong, here United Prairie Bank, who did everything right, is exactly an innocent party that would be harmed because it loaned over $3 million and has not been paid millions of what it had loaned. And so that second prong wouldn't be met. So we would never even get to a weighing of the equities because of those first two prerequisites. But assuming we could get over all of those, then I apologize. I don't remember if it's exactly this case, but I believe Barrett Brothers might have spoken about this, or it could be another one that I could look up. But one of the cases, major cases that is cited by the parties does address that question of, well, should we just kind of split the baby or whatever, and says, no, that's not, we don't look at the result of what will happen. We look at whether the equities favor giving priority to one party over another, and then what the result will be is not considered in that who has the equitable priority analysis. So in other words, you're not figuring out what's how to weigh the equities by kind of going backwards from the result that you would like to seek.
So what's your response to counsel's argument about the bright line rule? Is it because the two factors exist and under these facts it's undisputed that the bank had already filed and everybody was on notice?
Well, it's not creating a bright line rule because at least in situations like this, again, it's first a question of what rights does the surety subrogate to here already encumbered. And so I suppose in some ways in these facts that would always be the case. But then if the court didn't resolve that the case on that ground, then I suppose it would go then to these factors and it wouldn't always be a bright line rule. You can imagine perhaps different facts where the UCC filing statement wasn't as clear as it should be, or that it had been filed incorrectly or on the had to be refiled, or timing issues of that sort, or that the surety could show that for some reason it couldn't have known. Perhaps it made it issued the bond the same day of the filing, and so you wouldn't consider that to be, or you would consider that maybe an excusable mistake of fact. But those just aren't the facts that are before, the undisputed facts before this court. So I don't think it is a absolute rule that we are advocating for in any way. Again, we think that's exactly what the surety is arguing for in this case, because the surety is effectively saying, no matter what those facts are, we have some special status, and regardless of what the law that the legislature has passed about how creditors should perfect and protect their interests, and regardless of the fact that that is a reliable and efficient way to give others notice so that other creditors like sureties could protect their own interests, we should always have priority. So we don't believe that's what we are advocating for here, but in the undisputed facts of this particular case, you've got at least a 6-month lag time between a UCC filing and when the bonds were issued, and in one extreme, it's an entire year. So there's no excusable mistake of fact. As a matter of public policy, this is exactly why the UCC filing system exists, to avoid, frankly, disputes like this that could come before the court. And so that parties can protect their interests. And it's undisputed Granite Wright knows about this. It's a sophisticated surety. And in fact, if you look at the general agreement of indemnity that is in the record, I think it's Respondent's Addendum 43 to 44, I think something somewhere around there. In that agreement, it actually discusses that in addition to whatever equitable rights Granite Ray may have or desire to advocate for in the future, it also wants to take a security interest in Molnau Trucking's assets under the UCC. It's fully aware of this system that has been put in place to protect its own interests at not only at law, effectively. But here, Granite Ray did not file any perfected security interests after that agreement, and it did actually or file a financing statement after that agreement, and in fact, it did later file its own financing statement, UCC financing statement.
Counsel, is it fair? Is it fair then to say that it would be your position that, by virtue of the fact that that Granite had notice of the UCC filing and the perfected security interest, that it's not error if the court had not discussed equitable subrogation and applied and weighed and balanced factors and interests then, because by virtue of not meeting the first prong, if you will, that they were acting under justifiable or excusable mistake of fact, it doesn't even apply. Equitable subrogation wouldn't apply here.
Yes, we would agree with that, Your Honor. The district court, the way I read the opinion, again, kind of just assumed for the sake of analysis that perhaps there would be equitable subrogation here. So it jumped over consideration of that factor and just proceeded right to, well, even so, already encumbered by a perfected security interest, and so as a result, Granite Ray's rights are subordinate to the bank's rights. And that was, I think, the most efficient and straightforward way to resolve the case. But I do think also, because of that first element, and because this case presents facts that are unlike any of the other cases that are before you, that is another straightforward way to resolve the case, to say a surety cannot be deemed, and it or certainly couldn't meet its burden to show clearly and substantially that the equities weigh in its favor, that it acted under some kind of justifiable or excusable mistake of fact when there's been publicly filed UCC financing statements on the exact same types of assets 1 year to 6 months before they ever issue the bonds. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. And now we will turn back to counsel for appellant. We'll have 5 minutes on the clock. And feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of comments that I'd like to respond to. The first is the argument that the surety didn't follow these purported standards that it is somehow obligated to find. We don't believe that was ever briefed or argued at the district court, and that argument has been waived. That's in our brief on page 8 of our reply. But even if the court decides that those arguments weren't forfeited, those standards don't apply for equitable subrogation with respect to suretyship. I'd ask the court to look at the National Surety Company versus Bergen case from Minnesota, 1914. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case, and it says that when you are addressing suretyship and equitable subrogation, in order for it to be applied, the debt of a principal due a third party must be paid by the surety, and in doing so, the surety must have paid some debt on compulsion and not as a mere volunteer. These other standards are not applicable, in my opinion. That is the test for suretyship and equitable subrogation. So those standards and the case law cited by the bank confirm regarding context of mortgages, real property, federal tax liens. That's not what we're talking about here. We've got specific case law that is focused on just that. The argument then that they've turned to is, well, there's nothing due to them because we've perfected our security interest, which smacks and sounds like a bright line rule to me. But I would also argue then that you could turn that argument on its head, as we have done in our briefing as well, which is, okay, if that's the case, and we are compelled under the bond to pay a subcontractor and supplier. We are compelled to pay them. How is any of that money due Molnau Trucking? It is not, because the surety becomes subrogated to three people. It is subrogated to the owner. It is subrogated to the unpaid subcontractors and suppliers who they pay, and it is subrogated to the rights of the contractor. Council, why would the bank step in front of monies due subcontractors and suppliers when they've not paid that?
Council, what do we do with that, the initial piece of equitable subrogation to even apply? The party seeking subrogation has to have acted under a justifiable or excusable mistake of fact. What is the excusable mistake of fact that exists in this case that we should then get into the other balancing?
I don't think the court need reach that because, A, I don't think that argument was ever raised. But even if it does,
it's in the district court's order. I mean, the district court put it right in there as, like, here is what you have to do on equitable subrogation, and we can affirm on any grounds in the record.
Yeah, and I think the district court's focus was on the first-in-time priority. And I think if you look at the Berrigan case, which is specifically on point, which talks about suretyship and equitable subrogation and when it arises, it's fairly clear. And that language is parroted throughout the country. We've cited in our reply brief in a footnote 50 or so some odd cases that talk about when equitable subrogation arises for a surety. It's when we have to pay the debt that is due somebody that's properly due by our bond principal.
So you think that the two factors of when equitable subrogation applies is not something that we should even address in this case?
No, I don't think it's on point. I think the Berrigan case and the cases around the country talk about equitable subrogation and when it applies with respect to suretyship. We have specific case law on that. The case law that's cited by the bank is in regards to mortgages and tax liens and those kinds of filings, which are required under UCC Article 9. UCC Article 9, I would point out to the court, as cited in our brief, has never explicitly overruled equitable subrogation. The Eighth Circuit and other courts within the past decade have said there's no reason to overrule equitable subrogation, a time-honored tradition. That's not been overruled by Article 9. They can still stand alone. I respectfully disagree with my counsel. I think as soon as we say it's a first-in-time analysis, we have filed our and perfected our UCC, we have made notice to the world, there is no more equitable subrogation. You don't get to it because that is the beginning and the end of the question. And if we're going to do that, then we undercut hundreds of years of suretyship law around the country. So I would respectfully request the court to remand the decision back to the district court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel and for your briefing and the arguments here today. The case is under advisement, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. Thank you.